Welcome to Upahamu Africa, a podcast about life and politics on the African continent. I'm Kimmy Dion, one of your hosts, and I'm joined by my co-host, Rachel Beatty-Riedel. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Kim, and hello to our listeners. So in this week's episode, Kim and I are going to chat a little bit about Senegal's elections, Haiti's prime minister, a few other bits in our news wrap, and you'll hear Kim speaking with Lawrence Were, an assistant professor in the Department of Health Sciences at Boston University, where he does research on public health. Kim, can you give us a preview of your conversation?
Yes, Rachel. So Dr. Were is a health economist. So our conversation largely centered on his expertise in health insurance and how access to health insurance would improve health outcomes for individuals, but also improving community health. So if more people had health insurance, then they'd be able to access medical care, because even if there's universal, you know, whatever that means in quotes, like scare quotes, universal healthcare, there's still user fees or need to get transportation to a local hospital in order to get care. And those kinds of costs are typically covered by health insurance. And so we talk a little bit about, you know, the sustainable development goals and what it means, you know, for people to have health insurance and how that can have such a huge impact on especially, you know, the populations that he studied in the past, you know, pregnant mothers, people who have HIV, and also the people who studied their children, how this can have positive health impacts on their children as well. Now, he's currently doing some really exciting research on climate change and the fishing trade in and around the shores of Lake Victoria. And we'll link to a recent profile of that work that he's doing in our show notes. But I'm hoping we can have him on again, because we didn't even get to talking about his really exciting research on climate change. And because, again, he's a health economist, so he's not just studying, you know, I don't know, off the shelf data about like whether or not people have insurance and are they healthier? You know, like, sorry, not to make fun of economists, but sometimes that's the kind of work you guys do. But he's also like really just kind of seeing like, you know, what is the labor market like in this place, and how does that shape people's access to services, right? And what are like micro interventions that can be done, you know, maybe like something like health insurance that can make it. So I really wanted to understand, you know, some of this work that he's already done that's been published, but hopefully we can have him on again and talk about some of his work on climate change, which I think is really exciting. So I have to say, so I did that interview last week when I was at BU to give a talk, as part of an event of a special issue that of Studies in Comparative International Development that I co-edited with my dear friend and colleague Joe Harris, who's a sociologist at BU. And the whole time I was there, Rachel, I was like clicking refresh, because I wanted to know what is happening in Senegal, because I was trying to write a paper and I had this whole thing about Senegal and the deadline for the paper was coming. And I was just like, Macky Sall, what are you going to do? Because I don't know what to write in this thing and not look like a moron a month from now when it's published, because I don't know what you're going to do. So do we know what's happening? What's going on in Senegal? What's up, Macky Sall?
Yes. Yes, right. I'm clicking refresh every morning as well to find out what's been happening with the time change. So actually, you know, this may be old news by the time, you know, this airs in a few days, but this morning, new headlines appeared. Really exciting, you know, in terms of President Macky Sall announcing that the country was going to schedule presidential elections for March 24th. So the election date has now been set, despite this delay and uncertainty. He also simultaneously dissolved his cabinet and replaced his current prime minister, who was, by the way, you know, his kind of his replacement, his successor, who is the party's nominee for their presidential candidate. So that puts a lot of things in question, you know, around the party, but that the elections are going to be held. And, you know, this just comes back to some of the conversations that Kim and I, we've been having, you know, for many weeks now, months, around the power of different units, different entities within the country, the role of the courts kind of ordering that that the elections should be held. And so now a date is set. So Macky Sall will announce that he will leave government on April 2nd when his term will expire. So there may be some ongoing uncertainty about who would be ruling in any interim if there needs to be a second round of elections following this first round on March 24th, if no one wins the majority in the first round. So there's some question about what, like, when the swearing in of a new president might take place. But in any case, the elections will happen. And also a new interior minister, or the current interior minister, Siddiqui Kaba, will serve as prime minister in the interim after Macky Sall dismissed a current prime minister, Amadou Ba. So one other thing that's been interesting in the last few weeks, and this refers to Kim and I refreshing our browsers as well and staying in touch with folks who are in Dakar and across the country. So in the last few weeks, Macky Sall has also been releasing some political prisoners, kind of softening the stance against some opposition and civil society groups, and has even been allowing more demonstrations, adopting an amnesty law that allows for that kind of political prisoner release. And there's even talk that Macky Sall may pardon Ousmane Sonko, the leading opposition contender who's currently in jail. Not certain yet. The University of Cheikh Anta Diop in Dakar, one of a hotbed of protest and demonstration and a leading prestigious university, has been reopened. It's been closed since June when anti-government riots really erupted in Dakar. So that's positive. And 19 candidates are currently scheduled to compete for March 24th, including the dismissed prime minister, Amadou Ba, and many others, also including Ousmane Sonko's replacement or a stand-in, Bassirou Faye. So there are a lot of candidates, a lot of contestation, which is what democracy is all about. And one question I think is, you know, what changed? What's causing Macky Sall to set the date? And I think certainly domestic protest, the role of the courts, the role of the opposition in saying, no, this won't stand. All of these domestic forces coming together to push for a date. And also, Macky Sall would like to leave office. If he's going to leave office, he'd like to leave office as a kind of in good standing with the international community. And so we know that also international organizations have been saying, you know, Keep your good political capital for the next honorific nominations that could come your way, whether it be the AU or ECOWAS or, you know, bilateral relationships with the US or others. But there's been, of course, domestic pressure. There's been international kind of encouragement to maintain that his reputation or salvage a reputation as a Democrat as he leaves office.
Yeah, I was kind of wondering, like, what is he finally like? I'm into that Mo Ibrahim prize money, so let me take it back. Take backsies.
Exactly.
Just thinking about leaders and calling elections or not calling them, and how that's what takes us to Haiti this week. And for our listeners, just be assured, I know that Haiti is not in Africa. So does Rachel, right? We're not bringing it up because we're like, oh, Haiti's in Africa. We know that it's not in Africa. Though there is like these strong like Atlantic ties, right? Like if we think about like historical, you know, movements and revolutions, and Haiti's a really important place. But Haiti's in the news this week because of, you know, some, you know, really serious events that have happened of late. So organized criminal gangs have kind of coordinated to lead this mass prison break. There's a state of emergency declared. There's quite a bit of violence in the capital of Haiti, Port-au-Prince. And all of this is happening when the prime minister is where? In Africa. He's in Kenya, right? So, right. So this is we're talking about Haiti's embattled prime minister, Ariel Henry, who was in Kenya at the time that this mass prison break happened, and all of, and there was this, you know, declared state of emergency. You know, the reason why they have this, like, you know, the purported reason why they have this mass prison break and the, you know, this violence is because he was withholding elections, right? It's like, you know, this is, I don't know when leaders will learn, right? Just mm-hmm. hold, like, this is, again, I just want to say it's a very powerful thing about the way Jamie Black and Nick VandeWall opened their book about elections in Africa, that even if you don't ascribe to the idea that elections bring democracy, you have to agree that they focus our attention. And when there is supposed to be an election, it's a focal point where everyone can look and expect something to happen. And when that thing doesn't happen, you have these mass protests in the streets saying, Macky Sall, no, your constitutional date is up April 2nd. Mm-hmm. We don't want to see you there anymore. Right. And exactly. It doesn't matter the reasons why you think you're being magnanimous. Your term is up. Right. And I think similarly, you know, I'm not saying that, you know, organized criminal gangs in Haiti are the actors to whom we should be giving the stage to make claims. I am saying, though, that there is also a general popular dissatisfaction, right? And a desire for elections. Are elections going to answer all of Haiti's problems? Of course not, right? We're not so naive to believe that either. But it is interesting that the prime minister, Ariel Henry, had to go all the way to Kenya, right, to try to get an external security force, right, Kenyan military soldiers, to come back to his country to maintain order. Again, I'm not saying that Haitian people don't deserve security, stability, and peace. And I'm not saying that Kenyan soldiers wouldn't be able to provide that for them. I am saying we should think about what does it mean when the leader has to go literally to another region of the world to, like, find people to come. Like, if it were happening in another country, might we be calling these soldiers mercenaries, right? It's like one man's peacekeeping force is another man's mercenary, right? Like, I just want us to, like, think about what's happening, and as much as African countries are increasingly becoming more important with respect to, like, our understandings of international relations, including bilateral relations like this, right? And the various roles that they can play, and peacekeeping forces being a primary role that many African countries have played over the years. In this case, it was in a bilateral way, right, between two countries, as opposed to through a multilateral organization like the UN with the blue helmets. I just want us to think about, like, what does that mean? And, like, let's not just take for granted that the communication from the state is really, you know, what matters here. Okay, so I bring all that up and, you know, kind of talking about this, but it's just, why, when things are bad, do presidents and prime ministers leave the country? It just seems like a bad idea. Like, why do you leave? That was a choice.
Exactly. Kim, it's so interesting as you're mentioning this. I was just in Ghana last week, I guess. Yeah, just a few days ago. And the parallel. So I had the opportunity to go to, for the first time that I've ever been there, the Kwame Nkrumah Mausoleum. Mm. And so I was really thinking, just as you were talking about this scenario, of how many parallels there are with Nkrumah and the independence era. So first of all, the role of the president in terms of becoming more autocratic, you know, passing a law for a single party, repressing opposition, then leaving the country, interestingly, going to North Vietnam and to China in 1966. When he was in China or en route to China, his government was overthrown in a coup led by military and others, police, some civil service. And so what's so interesting about that, in just, you know, the parallel to today, right? China still in play, still a major force in terms of thinking about East versus West and the role of the United States potentially in supporting that coup, because Nkrumah was talking to quote unquote the East, or, you know, Communist Party leaders. And so both the role of external, you know, leaving the country, having that domestic uprising from while the leader is out of the country, but then also, like, what role does that external partner play? And you know, do they reinstate the leader? Do they harbor them? Such an interesting set of parallels, and really being there also reflecting on Nkrumah's legacy, a very complicated legacy. But his vision of Pan-Africanism is something that I continue to return to and thinking about how differently we might think about the independence era if such leaders, Nkrumah, along with Lumumba, and others, you know, had been able to stay in office, and what they might have built together.
Yeah. Another thing, you know, talking about this, you know, Pan-Africanism, and yeah, I was just on a Zoom call with Emmanuel Balogun, I think it was last week. And, you know, it was like, you know, out of luck, of sheer luck, right? I'm on a Zoom call with him right after ECOWAS lifts sanctions on Niger. And, you know, there's so like, it's really an exciting time, right, to think about like what's happening just within the region and international relations within African countries, and the role of not, again, not like the UN, not, you know, but of regional, not even the AU, right, but of regional organizations like the like ECOWAS. I know we haven't talked, like, listeners, we get it, like, this, what's been happening with ECOWAS, especially given the number of coups and, you know, all that's happened in West Africa in the last 2 years. And then this lifting of sanctions, it's, you know, is that ECOWAS weakness? Is that ECOWAS like trying to like regain some strength? I mean, I think there's lots of ways we can interpret that. And Rachel and I are not going to do that today. But hopefully in the
coming,
hopefully in the coming weeks, we will have someone on the show who can kind of help us think through like what this means for ECOWAS. Because I was wondering, Rachel, you know, with everything happening in Senegal, if Macky Sall did not call for elections before his constitutional limit, right, April 2nd, was ECOWAS going to do anything, and would it matter? And
right.
What's awesome about Senegalese democracy is, you know, what you were already saying about the role of, you know, Senegalese people are not going to wait for April 2nd to come around, right? They're going to signal to Macky Sall through the streets that they're not going to wait for him to decide he can't, you know, he can't do anything but stay in office, because, you know, I was just waiting for him to say like, oh, well, the people have spoken and I should stay as like, you know, a guardian of our democracy. It's like, you can't say that because the people have spoken.
Exactly.
And they want you to leave.
Exactly. They want to have their elections.
Yeah. Yeah. And so,
exactly.
So we'll continue, of course, to follow what's happening in the Senegalese elections, as well as other elections that are happening on the continent. Looking forward to, in a couple of weeks, hearing from, for example, Fu and Ami, their episode, kind of seeking Ghanaians' opinions and understandings of the candidates running in the Ghana elections that are slated for later this year. But for now, let's turn to our episode where I speak with Lawrence Were, who's faculty in the Department of Health Sciences at Boston University's College of Health and Rehabilitation Sciences. His research focuses on an application of health economics to estimating the impact of healthcare reforms. So he and I talk about his research on HIV positive individuals getting access to health insurance and how that has mattered for their access to care, as well as the inclusion of pregnant women in insurance schemes and how that also increases their access to care, looking at research in Kenya in particular. So have a listen to our conversation. So I'm fortunate to be here at Boston University because your colleague in sociology, Joe Harris, is hosting an event to celebrate this new publication of a special issue in Studies in Comparative International Development about global health. And since I was coming here, I said, oh, well, I would really love to meet your colleague and to learn more about his work. So in your work, you use health economics to estimate the impact of health reforms. And that includes studying things like health insurance, health coverage, and how these can, different interventions can impact community and individual health, particularly looking at marginalized populations, like informal traders, HIV positive people, pregnant women and their children. And I wonder if we can start there, talking about two articles that you wrote with colleagues. So one was published in BMC Public Health in 2020, and the other in BMC Health Services Research in 2017. Now, both of these scholarly works, in them you examine pregnant women and their access to skilled maternal care in Kenya. Can you tell us what you learned mattered for their access to skilled care?
So maybe some context,
sure,
and background.
Sure.
You know why this set of studies, and you know why this body of work. I think growing up in Africa, specifically in Kenya, I saw the HIV epidemic in real time, and you know, the for a very long time, the health systems were not equipped to be able to address the pandemic until really international NGOs like the Gates Foundation, in working with the UNAIDS and the WHO, were able to figure out how to make antiretrovirals affordable. And so for me, really, just given my personal interactions and experiences with HIV, and especially how, you know, there's a gendered aspect to HIV in sub-Saharan Africa. Women tend to carry more of the brunt of HIV, and therefore impacting even their children. Because for a long time, even when we had generic antiretrovirals for adult populations, there was no pediatric antiretrovirals.
Right.
You know, if you go back into the mid-90s, the early 2000s.
Yeah.
And so I got interested in this work because I wanted to figure out a systematic approach to addressing HIV. How can we work within health systems in limited resource settings to adequately address HIV? And I was looking down the road, which is most of the programming for HIV and maternal and child health have largely been donor funded.
Yes.
And so this is not going to last forever. History, global health history tells us that, and the studies have proven this, that, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s, the focus was on maternal and child health. You know, we had the expanded programs in immunization and, you know, lots of money for reproductive health. And when the HIV epidemic started taking over health systems mm-hmm. in sub-Saharan Africa, you could see the shift in dollars.
Right, donor priorities changed
from maternal child health mm-hmm. and immunization programs and reproductive health to HIV programming. Of course, there's been some work to try to integrate the two.
Right.
But you could see the substantial shift.
Mm-hmm.
And if that shift is beginning to happen, even with HIV, a lot of HIV funding has come from PEPFAR,
mm-hmm.
the Gates Foundation. And even right now in the U.S. Congress, congressmen do not want to renew PEPFAR.
Right, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, which was initiated by George W. Bush,
yes.
right? So, and the people who are standing in the way of it are co-partisans with George W. Bush. They're Republicans, but now they don't see a value in supporting that.
So when I started this work, the driver for me was to try and figure out how can we sustain, you know, HIV programming
mm-hmm.
in limited resource settings. And I decided to explore if insurance is an option
mm-hmm.
Because it so happened that a lot of countries, not just in Africa, but in mm-hmm. Southeast Asia and Latin America,
right.
are really pushing hard for universal healthcare coverage
right.
And, you know, trying to try out different modalities of achieving that, one vehicle being health insurance. And so there wasn't a lot being done in this specific area. So one of the first things I did, and this is how the two papers came about, was I wanted to provide population level evidence on what is the relationship between having insurance or not
mm-hmm.
and maternal outcomes, especially institutional delivery, both at the general population level, but specifically also for HIV positive pregnant women.
Right.
So the 2017 BMC Health Services research paper uses the Kenya Demographic and Health Survey, which is a nationally representative survey,
mm-hmm.
to demonstrate what would be the potential effect of having insurance on institutional delivery for pregnant women.
Right.
And I think the two key findings out of that paper, so what are the lessons learned?
Yeah.
Is insurance does have a tremendous effect on enabling institutional delivery. And this was kind of expected given what health economic theory tells us. But I think it was still interesting because this was in an environment where the government had a policy that pregnant women could get health services and delivery services at government institutions for free. But if you looked at the service provision and assessment data that is collected by the government, they were still charging user fees in government institutions. So there was still a case to be made. We need to look at what potentially having insurance would be. And this is in a country where insurance enrollment at this particular time was at about 17-20% across the whole country. Despite having the oldest social health insurance in sub-Saharan Africa, Kenya established the National Hospital Insurance Fund in 1967.
I didn't know that.
4 years after gaining independence.
Yeah.
And there is the sessional paper number 10 that set the basis for setting up NHIF in 1967. So it has the oldest social health insurance program in sub-Saharan Africa. So we were able to show that having insurance mm-hmm. does have tremendous influence on the ability to deliver institutions. But we said, okay, that's fine. But what if there's some disparities? So we decided to look at how does wealth influence this relationship between insurance and institutional delivery?
Mm-hmm.
And we found that the poorest pregnant women benefited the most from being enrolled in insurance. So really, that's what you'd want to see. The people that have the greatest need benefit from a program like insurance. So that was a 2017 paper. The 2020 paper focused specifically on HIV-positive pregnant women. And for this paper, we got electronic medical records from AMPATH. AMPATH is a HIV healthcare system mm-hmm. in Western Kenya mm-hmm. that has been funded by PEPFAR and UNAIDS and USAID for decades now, and has made a tremendous, tremendous impact on HIV. They have a broad HIV programming. And so from AMPATH, I had 5 years worth of data on about 32,000 HIV positive pregnant women with 500,000 plus records of clinical encounters over 5 years. And the data set also included whether or not they signed up for NHIF. And again, in this paper, we're able to demonstrate even for HIV-positive pregnant women, having insurance is beneficial, mm-hmm. but in two additional ways. So we stratified the analysis to focus on socioeconomic status.
Right, as you had in the 2017 paper.
Yes, but now we also focused on disease severity as measured by CD4 cell count.
Right. So higher CD4 cell count means that your disease severity is, yes. right? It means you have more HIV in your system, right? Yeah. And suggesting that you're more ill.
And the increases the likelihood of mother to child transmission of HIV.
Exactly.
Right. So it brings us back to that question of pediatric HIV.
Yeah.
And so again, HIV positive pregnant women of lower socioeconomic status benefited more than HIV-positive pregnant women of higher socioeconomic status. Now, based on CD4 cell count, the sickest HIV-positive pregnant women also benefited more relative to those with lower CD4 cell count. Mm-hmm. And so now we're seeing a double effect here. Mm-hmm. Not only is insurance facilitating access to institutional delivery, but it's actually facilitating access to institutional delivery at two additional levels, to those that needed the most given low socioeconomic status, and again, those that needed the most given their HIV severity.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is information. So once these studies came out and these results were out, I actually went back to Kenya and put together representatives from NHIF, from the Ministry of Health, from AMPATH, all stakeholders that were involved in this and presented these results to them. And it has had effects over time, like AMPATH now is experimenting with community-based health insurance in the HIV populations to try and get, you know, people more coverage to have access to insurance.
So let's talk a little bit about what that means. So what does health insurance look like in Kenya? You know, how does one even buy into a health insurance program, and what does it cover?
Actually, the coverage, what the insurance covers, mm-hmm. is pretty comprehensive. Let me step back.
Sure.
So there are largely three ways you can enroll in insurance in Kenya. If you're formally employed and your employer offers health benefits, they will sign you up with a private insurance plan. Mm-hmm. So that's option one. Option two is the National Hospital Insurance Fund, which recently got changed to the Social Health Insurance Fund because the government just amended the Health Insurance Act in December last year. Now, the NHIF, which is now transitioning to the SHIF, mm-hmm. Is open to both those in the formal sector and those in the informal sector. Those in the formal sector, the deductions for the premiums are based on your income levels and are taken directly from your paycheck. So the contributions, your employer contributes directly. So it becomes a deduction, a monthly deduction from your paycheck. Those in the informal sector can sign up voluntarily. You can go to an NHI office and register and have your biometrics taken, and you pay 500 shillings every month
okay.
to get coverage. And you get a card and you get assigned to a health facility that you can go seek your care.
Okay.
And there's the different kinds of products within NHIF, but they offer coverage from, you know, regular screening to hospitalizations to cancer treatment to institutional delivery. It's a comprehensive package. And so, you know, those are, and you can outrightly buy private insurance if you can afford it. But those are largely the ways in which one can access insurance. In fact, we've done some interesting work that we haven't published yet.
Okay.
We've done a national level analysis of spatial and temporal access to insurance. So we've used GIS data to map insurance enrollment across the country. Then we've calculated travel time to the insurance offices across the country, because you need the offices for your biometrics and registration.
Right.
And of course, the disparities by regions. The 2010 Constitution created something known as the Equalization Fund, and it identified 13 marginalized counties that get additional resources from the government to try and equalize them to the other counties. And the disparities in insurance enrollment, and some of them quite high in this Equalization Fund counties.
Meaning places like Nairobi might have higher rates of people being insured than maybe parts of Western Kenya or coastal Kenya.
Mostly Northern Kenya.
Northern Kenya, okay.
Coastal Kenya, some sections. Mm-hmm. We've even done a hotspot and cold spot analysis, which is, you know, some areas tend to have a higher concentration of enrolled clusters.
Mm-hmm.
But even with those clusters, there are some disparities. And for you to really figure those out, you have to do a hotspot and cold spot analysis.
Right.
Yeah.
And what are the disparities, even in these places where insurance enrollment is high, are they also socioeconomic?
Yes. So we've even done this in Nairobi,
mm-hmm.
where we zero in a section of Nairobi where we know on one side of the street, there is an informal settlement.
Mm-hmm.
On the other side of the street, there's a more middle class neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see a cold spot in the informal settlement. You can literally map the informal settlement and see the cold spot, while across the street, the more middle income is a hot spot.
Right.
But
so it's not a matter of distance,
no.
Right? Because they're effectively the same. They're just across the street from each other.
They're all in Nairobi. So if you just look at the national level and you're looking at the hotspots across the country,
mm-hmm.
Nairobi is going to be a hotspot.
Yeah.
But if you zoom into Nairobi, then you begin to pick these hot and cold spots.
Mm-hmm.
And they reflect these disparities that are socioeconomic.
And so do you anticipate then that kind of taking, like bridging from your earlier work to this work about coverage, you know, people's ability to access and enroll in health insurance. Do you expect you would see similar health outcomes, that people with greater access to health insurance will have better health outcomes, whether that's measured as, you know, delivering babies in a skilled facility or something else like, pre-diabetes, cholesterol, right? Kind of these other kind of chronic health conditions or just, or even other kind of, maybe even infectious disease related, health outcomes.
Yes, I expect that. In fact, this analysis that you've done, we are calling it health insurance deserts. We are trying to map what I'm calling health insurance deserts.
Yeah.
Right? That's what we are trying to do here. We've actually developed a metric that allows us to identify these health insurance deserts. Do I expect to see some desert effect on other outcomes?
Yeah.
Yes. In fact, I am working with a couple of colleagues from California at the City of Hope, which is a massive cancer center.
Yeah. One of the best in the world.
Yes.
Yeah.
And we are getting ready to go to Kenya in March to do cervical cancer screening. But we already know that women who get screened for cervical cancer and are found to have severe level of disease that come from limited resource settings have a hard time accessing the care.
Right.
Because if you need to go for radiation or something like that, you have to go to one of the referral hospitals. And from time to time, it is not unusual for a couple of those radiation machines to be down at some of these referral hospitals. And so across the country, you may find at some point in time, only two are working or something in the public sector.
Right.
And so it means if you don't have insurance to cover you even in the private sector, then you have to wait for when these machines come up and work. And there is a cost. You may need to travel, for example, from Kisumu to Eldoret. And what are the costs? Transportation, accommodation, because it takes a couple of days, right? Accommodation and all these things. And so,
and not just for one person, but also for your health guardian to accompany you so that you can access this debilitating treatment. I mean, it's certainly, in the long run, it's better for your health, but actually getting radiation is exhausting and can make you ill.
Yes. So yeah, I expect that, and we know for diabetes, we know even access to insulin is a problem, and people ration insulin. The government has monthly free diabetic clinics, they call them. For example, in Nairobi, you can go to Kenyatta Hospital and get your monthly supply of insulin if you are diabetic and insulin dependent. But it's never enough. They try to give as much insulin to as many people as they can, so people end up not getting enough insulin for the month. So I would expect the same across different conditions, broadly speaking.
So I wonder if we can talk a little bit about universal insurance versus universal coverage. And I ask this because, you know, we live in a country where there's purportedly universal insurance, but not necessarily universal coverage. And when I battle with my own health insurance provider or think about, you know, others who struggle to get insurance to cover the care that they need, I wonder sometimes if what it might look like if we just pulled insurance out altogether and just provided universal coverage. Now, I know that that's kind of a radical idea. I accept that that's true. But you've written about universal coverage in the Lancet Global Health and how and the innovative ways to finance access to care. And so I wonder if you could tell our listeners a little bit more about that and your own thinking about insurance as a way for expanding coverage.
Yes. So in my mind, I think of universal coverage as an umbrella. Imagine walking down the street on a hot summer day, and now we're dealing with extreme weather on both ends.
Yeah.
Lots of rain one day, lots of sun and heat the following day, and heat waves and everything. So imagine you're walking down the street, and it's too hot.
Mm-hmm.
An umbrella would make much of a difference to keep you cool.
Yeah.
Or imagine you're walking down the street on a rainy day. An umbrella would help keep you dry.
Yeah.
Right? And so this metaphor really, because health events are like heat waves and massive rainstorms.
Yeah. Right?
They hit you hard. So for me, universal healthcare coverage is this umbrella that we can use to protect people from financial risk and catastrophe that is associated with care. It means people accessing care when they need it, where they need it,
right?
In a way that is respectful and, you know, acknowledges their human rights.
Yeah.
So I think of universal coverage as this umbrella under which we can meet people's health needs, variety of health needs, in a way that is equitable, that is respectful, that is dignifying, but does not also lead to financial catastrophe and leads to quality health outcomes.
Yeah.
On the other hand, universal health insurance is a tool that we can use to cover people,
mm-hmm.
right? So, insurance can help facilitate access to care mm-hmm. when people need it.
Mm-hmm.
Insurance can help minimize financial risk, you know, all these things that we'd like the umbrella to do. And so I think of, that's how I think about these two things. And so my thoughts on universal coverage and universal health insurance as a vehicle to achieve universal coverage is largely driven by informality. And the idea of informality is that economies tend to be dichotomized into two, that there's a formal sector where, you know, really largely it's for tax purposes. The government can collect taxes from people engaging in economic activities. That's a formal sector. The informal sector tends to focus on activities that are much more diverse,
mm-hmm.
but do not have formal mechanisms for taxation. And that's the informal sector. And remember, we talked about taxation influencing how people pay premiums.
Right.
Right? So I think informality is going to greatly influence what happens with universal health coverage / universal insurance because majority of those economically active in Africa, in Southeast Asia, in Latin America, in the Caribbean are all in the informal sector.
Yeah.
70-80% in some places.
Right.
All in the informal sector. And so we need to figure this informality question if we are really going to achieve UHC.
Yeah. And so for now, the bridge for that is health insurance.
Yeah. One way to make that bridge is health insurance. But I think we have a long way to go.
So the last question we always ask our guests on the show is if there's anything you're reading that you would recommend to our listeners.
I've been reading a lot about Disease X.
Disease X?
Yes.
What is this? Forgive me, is this something I should know?
So at the end of last year, the WHO created what I'm going to call a task force, but a group to begin looking into what is likely to cause the next pandemic? And are we ready? And because we do not know what that is, the term being floated around is Disease X.
Okay.
Can we potentially understand a potential Disease X?
Yeah.
And then assess whether or not we are ready for Disease X? And how would we respond to Disease X?
Yeah.
And the reason why I've been reading about this is, for example, COVID, SARS-CoV-2. If you go back to the literature and do a deep dive, I think there was a Chinese scientist, I think back in 2007 or 8, that wrote a paper of the potential of SARS-CoV-2 virus from horseshoe bats in China leading to a pandemic if a zoonotic event happened. It took about 13 years.
That's amazing.
Yes. So I've been thinking a lot about Disease X.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing your ideas and your work with us.
It's been a pleasure. Hopefully it's beneficial to, you know, all stakeholders, research scientists,
and policymakers.
Policymakers,
right?
Yes.
If we think about, you know, I guess what is really important to me is that your work, it focuses on access to care and in particular on people who wouldn't have it otherwise. But I think, you know, if there's something we learned from the pandemic, it's that all of our health is dependent on even people with the least power having access to good care, because we're connected in these ways. And so it's, I think the work you do is really important.
Yeah. So, you know, the way I think about it is whether or not you're rich or you're poor.
Yeah.
We are all living in critical times.
Indeed.
And so if we are not deliberate, then the critical times might overtake us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kim.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Ufahamu Africa. You can find more episodes, show notes, and transcripts on our website, ufahamuafrica.com. This podcast is produced and managed by Megan DeMitt, with help from production assistants Chukwufunanya Ikechukwu, Alex Kozak, Harry Stoltz, and Macheri Mugwero. Our non-resident podcast fellows are Ami Tamaklo, Fu Asedu, Expedi Olugu, Basil Ibrahim, and Hopalong Botulkane. We are generously supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York and receive research assistance from Cornell University and the University of California, Riverside. Our music is courtesy of Kevin McLeod. Until next week, Safiri Salama.